Hello, loves.
I'm Sarah Gomez, and you're listening to Romancing the Story, a podcast about romance writing, reading, and finding love in story structure. We're at episode number 14. On today's episode, I talk with Amber Royer on character motives, agency, and how they influence your fave rom-coms. All that with a pinch of chocolate for good measure. With that said, let's dive right into the episode.
Please give a big welcome to creative writing instructor and fiction author of Chocolate Aliens, Solving Murders, and of course, Falling in Love, Amber Royer. Yay!
Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Absolutely. I just want you to know too, I do have a big mug of coffee in your honor right now. Because I know, of course, because I know too, you're, I always see you have like the most fun Instagram, pictures of like where you're traveling as far as coffee and tea and all these really cool exotic like flavors you always have, which is always really super intriguing to me.
Yeah, and I'm excited to be able to go back to coffee shops now because we did the whole vaccination thing and things are starting to open up again. And I don't know if I told you guys, but we moved up to McKinney in the middle of the pandemic. So there's a whole different set of small businesses that we've been getting to know.
Nice. Yeah, that must have been an adventure kind of trying to move midst of a pandemic. But
it was, but it was a good thing.
Good. I'm looking forward to seeing all those new shops pop up in my feed and Instagram.
I've got a whole list.
Oh, nice. So we've met at several writing events and book releases. And every time I see you, I feel like I've learned something new about writing after hearing you speak. You've been teaching creative classes for a while, but what continues to draw you to teaching even out in the wild of writer events?
You know, I love talking about writing. It's one of the things I've done so much research on over the years, and getting to share ideas and learn from my students. I always learn something new. One time I was talking about the whole concept of saving the cat. And I was talking about Blake Snyder's book and how you can have that whole opening from Disney's Aladdin back when the animated one was the only thing, and how that song and dance really does form a save the cat and also let you get to know the character. And one of my students was just like, yeah, so whenever you apply this in one of my stories, that's your save the cat. And I'm like, I hadn't even noticed that I had used the technique that I was describing in the context of that character. But she brought it up and kind of tweaked the way I thought about the concept.
Isn't that funny too? We as writers, I think we subconsciously do those things and we don't think about it. We don't know sometimes even the name of what to call these techniques, but there is a method to the madness.
Yeah, and so since I've started teaching and having to look at student work, it's like I start to see what I've done in my own work. Mm-hmm. And then I start to see where people, they get the common advice, but the application is often missing. Story Like a Journalist came out of some of the classes where I had some students and they had taken novel writing 1 through 3. And so we talked about character, we talked about plot, we talked about all these things. They wrote homework assignments, 5 weeks at the pop, 15 weeks at a time. And they would get stuck. And then they would be like, well, how do you thread all of these pieces together to make a novel? And I'd be like, well, you just put it in order to make a novel. But how? And that really, if you don't know structure, can be really hard. And so we would do outlines and we would put together structure. And they would still be like, but how do I do transitions? And how do I know how many chapters and all of that kind of stuff? And so I realized that a lot of people are more comfortable with worksheets. And over the course of teaching for 10 plus years, I'm going on 15 years now over there at UTA, because I started in 2008 teaching adult continuing ed.
Wow.
I found that I had developed all of these different worksheets to try and explain the concepts. And so this, we have a mutual friend, Catherine, who is also a marketing person. She took a look at my website and she's like, well, why don't you have a book? And so I took the concepts and I wrote some text. And then most of this book is different worksheets for application.
I love how you've taken that, how you've taken like these ideas of like little bite-sized pieces of structure to make it more palatable for writers, yeah. easier for them to actually put their ideas. Cause that in, like, that's the biggest challenge. One of the biggest challenges I have this big nebulous idea, but I'm just like, how do I make it actually functional, right? As a novel.
Yeah. And I find that a lot of the advice people get is so nebulous. They're like, well, just do it. Or, you know, you'll feel it and the structure will come. But I find if you outline it different ways, you will find it. And to me, you ask what keeps drawing me back to teaching. It's when I get to see people level up. Mm. It's when I get to see a student who's like, yes, I have indie published my own book now because I have the confidence from learning how to structure something properly. And there's that aha moment when you see that they realize that they can go from where they've been with their art to some totally different place. And I've gotten help along the way, working with different publishing professionals, taking classes myself, and being able to pay that back and see other writers get there is just the biggest reward.
And I love that idea too, that you've taken other classes and seeing them level up, because as writers, I think we're always learning something new, right? Mm-hmm. Always a new process, always a different writing method. You know, because what may work in one of our first books or former books may not work in the next one.
I have a little bit of an addiction to writing manuals.
Nice. So having read your Chalkover series, I know you really have a heart for fleshing out great characters that work within the story without disrupting a plot or feeling like the characters were just cast into a role, right? So tell us a bit about how you manage that.
Well, I think that also comes from preparation. And once again, I have worksheets about all of that.
For that as well.
I do. I'm a big believer in character interviews. And so you figure out if you have a character in mind to start with, that's a good place to go from. So like in my Bean to Bar Mysteries, Felicity was a character to start with. And so I fleshed her out and then figured out, you know, who her potential love interest would be based on who she was. But if you have an idea to start with, like the Chalkoverse book started as an idea. It actually started as a NaNoWriMo project. And it was very different than what the finished book ended up being. It was something kind of like Noises Off in space. And there was a cocoa pod and it was basically like a football and people were trading it back and forth. And it wasn't until I really figured out what the story was about that I figured out who Boat was. And she went through several renditions before I figured out the exact type of person she needed to be, what character flaw she was dealing with, why Brill was such an interesting foil for everything that she was. But I already had the idea in place that it was going to be bigger than what I had originally anticipated. And she needed to be larger than life. And so figuring out that she needed to be larger than life, that she needed to fill certain spaces within the story world, enabled me to move forward with the book and create a character that I think is very memorable.
Right. And I completely agree. I feel like I don't really make much traction on any story unless I can figure out or define at least, right, what motivates my character or specific, like you said, like things that are important, that what, how they need to function within that story.
Yeah. You have to know who they are to know what they want, and you have to know what they want in order for the plot to make sense.
Exactly. And so when you say character interviews, because I've heard of this and I've seen like one or two, I haven't seen a whole lot. What do you think is like important to ask within like from those characters?
What they want. That is the biggest, most important question is you take the character basically into a white room. If it makes you feel better, tell them, you're not going to remember this afterwards. Here's a glass of wine. We're going to chat. and you say, what do you want out of this story? Why are you here? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when you find the character's goal, you can figure out what needs to happen to them in the plot, even if they're not going to get what they want. Like if a character is going to die in the course of the story, there are often ways that you can fulfill their biggest want before that happens, so that when they do leave the story, there's a sense of closure for them first. And not always. I mean, sometimes you want that ripped apart, didn't finish the story arc kind of thing, where them not achieving what they wanted becomes the heart of it. But sometimes that satisfaction. Mm-hmm. So in book one of the Chocoverse, there was a character who, and it wasn't in the interview, it was in the course of the story, is talking to my protagonist, and she thinks she's going to die, and asked him what he would do if he only had a limited amount of time left. And he told her. And that kind of sparked everything that happened to him in the second book. Because I knew exactly if he had to die how he wanted to. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, it kind of felt inevitable. Some of the other questions, you want to get visceral. You want to get to the things that are going to evoke emotion. So sometimes I'll ask a character, like, if you didn't survive this story, who would mourn you? Who would give your eulogy? And that's going to give you a true emotional response if you could get yourself into the head of that character of what they're going to do, mm-hmm. How they're going to respond in a lot of stressful situations, how they feel about family and love and all of those kind of things. You know, you told me you've read the Chocoverse. So yeah. Brill, when I did that question in the character interview I did with him initially, and I learned a lot more about the depth of him as I went along, but his initial response was to try and bribe me to make sure that he would survive the book.
That's such a Brill thing to do too. That is so Brill. Oh my gosh. Wow, though, that is very emotional. You're right though. That really tells me a lot of what I would need to know about a character. Like, yeah. Who would mourn them? What would they do if they only had a limited time left? Tells me what's important to them and who Absolutely. They are as a character. Those are really, yeah. Because some of the ones I saw wasn't so emotionally driven. Let me put it that way, that some of the character interviews I've seen, but man, that gets right to the heart.
Yeah. Well, some of them can be telling in other ways. One of the ones that I found somebody else had done was, what kind of shoes does your character wear?
Oh,
and that can tell you a great deal too, because if you have a character who is a bad guy, right? Mm-hmm. The bad guy who wears wingtips and, you know, is always meticulous and dressed to the nines, and the bad guy who's wearing basketball sneakers are very different people. And if you're trying to figure out how to picture your character, where to start building them, and you don't know them psychologically well enough yet, you can start with those questions like, what kind of shoes do they wear? Name five things in the character's refrigerator right now. And that's going to help you get a overall vision of who they are, so that when you start asking the psychological questions, you can start to build on, this is my physical image and a few traits that you've already put in place.
Yeah. And that's, wow, what a great tool. To kind of start out simply and then build from there into the big emotional questions. Because sometimes too, I did that one time, try to examine my characters from an emotional standpoint. And I don't think I had the foundation right. I didn't quite have the foundation there to kind of know, like you said, what they really want. Kind of, you had said about Bo, how you kind of had to find that after a little while. So you mentioned too, revising an outline midstream and rewiring a whole storyline to give a secondary character more space in the plot.
Yeah. So that's actually two different incidents. Those are both from the Chocoverse books. And, you know, those were more complicated than the mysteries. So I did a lot more revising and changing direction because I had this huge verse I was trying to work with. Mm-hmm. Whereas a mystery, the constraints of it, as far as the plot, are fairly simple. You introduce suspects, you investigate, you solve, right? Where sci-fi, you can go so many different places. And I had this huge verse with all of these characters. And the one where I revised the outline midstream was whenever I realized Bo was not getting to have enough character agency. And this was in the second book. And I have a scene where, so Bo and Brill are dealing with these giant shark type aliens who fight to the death and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And something has happened and Brill is in danger. And in the original outline, there's another character that steps in and takes on the duel so that Brill can survive that scene and things can happen that move forward. And we were talking in the notes for this about character agency. Well, that takes away Bo's character agency to a great deal because she's in a situation where somebody needs to step up for her love interest and somebody else does it. And so when I got to that scene, I realized she is such a take charge person that having her step back and let somebody else take care of that is not in her nature. Mm. And so I revised probably three chapters of where the outline was going to put her in the center of it and move everything else away. And it actually dovetailed with where I was originally going. And so the other thing that we were talking about with revising it to have more room for a secondary character, that was Chesla. I don't know why, but everybody loves Chesla even more than Bo. I've had people tell me that she is their favorite character because they love that combination. She's a cat-like alien who is a warrior and a nurturer. And she is loyal beyond everything else. And people really love that. And so whenever I did the first version of the book that Angry Robot bought, my editor there told me that I had introduced this awesome character at the beginning of the book. And then once Bo got separated from her, physically, she was on one planet, Bo's in a spaceship, you know, all these kind of things, that I couldn't let such an awesome character fall by the wayside. Mm-hmm. And so there are phone calls between the two, because I wrote it first person. I don't highly recommend writing a space opera first person, but it was such an intimate story and it meant so much to me that I did it that way. Mm-hmm. So when they get physically separated, I had to do holograms and phone calls and stuff to keep Chesla in the story. And I realized after the reaction to the first book and so many people saying that Chesla was their favorite, she didn't really have a huge part in book two. I mean, she was mainly just there in book one. And I realized that she needed to be there in book two. She needed her own romance triangle. She needed all of this stuff that actually plays into the ending. And whenever I rewrote it, I assume you've read book three, and I'm not going to spoiler it for the audience, but without her being there at the end, a lot of the themes just would have fallen flat because she's at the center of all of this intergalactic. You have two planets who are at odds and her planet's in the middle. Mm-hmm. And without her there, it would have been a much more challenging way to get to the ending.
Right. And first off, Chesla speaks to me on a spiritual level. I love her so much.
Oh, thank you.
She's such a great character. But I love too that you, even though you didn't know it quite at the end, that it, like you made space for her in the second book. Cause I've heard of, like, you know, as writers sometimes, you know, we're so close to it. Maybe we don't, like, I loved how your editor called it out because sometimes we're so close. We don't see that. We don't see how awesome those characters can be. And I cannot think of the series at all without Chesla. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I can't even think without her being in it, like as pivotal as she is in the later book, you know?
Yeah.
I can't imagine the book being what it was without her.
It's important to get other eyes on your work, to listen to what people are saying about it, because if you don't, then you can miss out on a lot. And I think when I deal with beginning writers, I do a lot of critiquing and stuff like that. It's the ones that are willing to at least consider restructuring things, to at least consider whether you've really chosen the correct protagonist for your story, that are the ones that make progress so much faster.
Absolutely. Yeah, I didn't even think about that, but you are correct. You're right. I've been, you know, we kind of circle sometimes with some of the writer critique groups and like near us in the events. And I know I've come across some writers who we kind of read their work and we kind of like, or at least the groups I'm in, we looked at it and said, are we sure this is telling the story of the right person? Because it seems more impactful, or it seems like it affects this other character way more.
Yeah. And I've done that myself. I have a sci-fi piece that's time travel that I have still not gotten to the point where my agent likes it enough to want to move forward with it. Mm. And the first version I wrote from the point of view of a girl from the time period they went to. So she's 16 in Victorian England, and I wanted her to be the center of this story with her robot dog. And it has this whole theme of the dog is kind of a monster. Is she Dr. Frankenstein? All this kind of stuff. And if I had left it at that, and I might eventually write that as its own story one day, it would have been fine. But then I introduced this whole time travel element that became pivotal to the story I wanted to tell. And she didn't have the she didn't have the education to understand the physics, and she didn't have the social power to really be in some of the situations I needed her to be in without really breaking what that time period was. And the guy who I realized was actually the protagonist of the piece only had two lines in the first draft.
First of all, that sounds amazing. I do want to read that. I want to read that right now.
Okay.
But that is so, that's incredible that you actually found that it was this one character who had two lines. Mm-hmm. You were able to identify that. How did you know it was him?
Well, I did this exercise, and it was one of the instructors. I cannot remember the instructor's name, who had come when Candace Havens had that group, and it was all online little class. Mm-hmm. And it was a class on writing a premise. And so, you know, the basic write a premise, and I've never done it before because there was a lot of just in life, you build it and it will come in the background for writing that I had had. And so I did this exercise, and you're supposed to say, basically, cool character does difficult thing despite opposition or else bad thing happens. And I'm sitting there trying to write it. And it's like, with the help of these time travelers, this character does. And basically it came down to this character observes. And this character observes is not enough to drive a story. And it's not enough for her to be a protagonist. And I think a lot of beginning writers also fall into that trap as they build a character who is interesting in and of themselves. And then they just have them float along in the story, observing what is going on around them. And that gives them basically zero character agency. And if a character has zero agency, they're not a protagonist, because by definition, a protagonist is moving forward. So I had obviously cast the wrong person. She would make an excellent side character. She would make an excellent villain. You know, the Dr. Frankenstein thing gives you all kinds of things to play with. She had the perfect amount of agency for that, but she didn't have the agency for the time travel plot.
So just for clarification, how do you define character agency? Or what do you think of as character agency?
It's the ability to make decisions that change direction and irrevocably affect the plot. So if a character's decisions are quickly undone or have no consequence, they still do not have agency.
And so what, I mean, and obviously like that's incredibly important to help move the novel forward.
And, you know, sometimes characters can seem to have agency, but it's just busy work. And I've had a number of conversations with people whenever I've critiqued first chapters. And I'm like, what is your character actually doing in this chapter? And it's like, well, he's moving and carrying things and going about his business and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, okay, but what is he actually doing? Something important that affects the plot. A character has to want something, has to make a decision. So if the character is not doing something irrevocable, making a decision that cannot easily be taken back, they haven't actually done anything in the story, no matter how busy they are. There's kind of a corollary to that. It's a writing exercise that I've done with teenagers and I've done with adults. And it's the idea of three choices. Because if you put somebody in a situation, they can choose yes or no fairly easily. And usually there's one obvious answer to a yes or no question based on what the morality of the character is. You know, does the good guy save the drowning puppy? Yes. Does the bad guy save the drowning puppy? No. Right? That's not really agency. That's not making decisions. But you put a character in a situation where there is a problem that is going to affect the plot, and I'll have them write that part out and then ask them to come up with three possible decisions the character could make in that situation and tell them it can't all be the same thing. So it can't be the character hides behind a bush, the character jumps in the river to hide, the character climbs a tree to hide. Those are all the same thing. Give me other possible decisions. And about 70% of the time, the writers fail the exercise because they can't see anything other than what they've put in line for the plot. And so asking the character to make a decision that isn't in the plot or that isn't already defined by where they want the plot to go and have three viable options that are actually things the character might do, because, you know, you can't have the character be like, okay, so there's somebody in the house, you want to protect the person in the house. Burning the house down is not an option for most characters. And if you put that down on your list of three just to have something else, it doesn't psychologically fit the character. And so I like mark that one out. So you have to have three viable options the character could do in a way to deal with the situation.
I've come across some books or even writings of my own where things happen to characters and they don't really have, like you said, that agency or those actionable items that they take like consciously in the plot, and things are just happening to them or from people around them, which does give an illusion that maybe they are the main character when they're really not.
Yeah. And I mean, you can play to where you have a viewpoint character who is not your main character. You can do Watson to Holmes or Nick to Gatsby kind of thing. But that's structurally very different than trying to cast the person as a protagonist when they aren't actually doing the things. Because, you know, if you've got something like Nick to Gatsby, the whole point of having a separate narrator is that he can tell you things about Gatsby Gatsby would never say about himself. But Nicholas never really takes center stage to the point where you feel like he's trying to be the protag. So it's a very different feel to it, but he is telling Gatsby's story very clearly early on. It's not like you have him and we feel like he is the protagonist and then all of a sudden Gatsby's making the decisions. That's the difference.
I know. So you write, obviously you've written like sci-fi with like the Chocoverse series and mystery with the Bean to Bar series. So are those characters writing those characters and their agency, or have they been different? Have you found from like one genre to the next?
Agency is displayed in different ways in different genres. It really depends on what scale things are happening on. So if you need a character who can cross star systems and drive drones and battle and, you know, all these kind of things, that is one kind of agency. But there's not less agency in, say, a romance. Because if you look at what goes on in like a Jane Austen novel, there is an equal amount of opportunity to do damage to people psychologically by making wrong choices. If one of my favorite Jane Austen novels is Emma, and it's because she has caused all of her problems entirely by herself, and she has to make choices and use her agency to become a better person and actually earn back what she had with the guy at the very beginning. Because, you know, her and Knightley at the beginning, if Emma had stayed out of other people's business, if she had paid attention to what he was telling her, if she hadn't tried to find love in other places, they could have had a happily ever after on like page three. But she messed it all up. She lost his respect, and then she has to gain it back. So that's a huge amount of agency in a different way. But she is still making decisions. She is still shaping her destiny and the plot and everything just as much as somebody is in a huge space opera. Maybe the consequences are a smaller world, but the consequences to Emma's community of everything she's done are huge. So it's just a different feel and a different scope, but she still has a great deal of agency.
And that's really important to note too, because I didn't even think of that, but agency can be more than just, you know, physical, like physically driven things. It could be emotional. It could be psychological, like you mentioned.
To me, if you look at Shakespeare, you look at Macbeth, who has more agency, Lady Macbeth or Macbeth?
I always say Lady Macbeth.
She's driving it, right?
Yeah. She's feeling it. She is really in it. So,
but she doesn't actually do the things.
No, she doesn't.
She manipulates others to do the thing, you know?
Yeah. She's like the driving force behind that entire play.
And that's where you get that feeling of agency, because she's the one making decisions. I would say he has very little agency because he is just listening to what other characters tell him.
Yeah. Like she was manipulating. That's a great example. She had all the agency there because she was manipulating the whole way.
And you can even give secondary characters more agency than you would think. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite examples to come across is, if you have a butler who's in the room with the protagonist and one of the other major characters, and they're saying something, the butler overhears it. He then has a choice of what to do with that information. He's not necessarily a major character, but he's going to get to display agency, whether he shares that information. So say they're planning a heist and he decides to go to the police, you know, could change the entire course of the story.
Yeah. Or he could do anything with that information. Tell a rival, tell some accidentally let it slip. And then, somebody else finds out about it. What happens next with that?
Yeah. And so you've got, he could tell the cops, he could tell a rival. Mm-hmm. What's the third option? My first third option is he could blackmail his boss.
Ooh, that's a good one. I like that.
So we've got, he passes the test, right? He's got at least three possible choices he could make.
Mm-hmm. And all very viable options that would definitely influence the plot and kind of, chart the trajectory of what happens. Kind of touched upon it earlier, but like all your books have like a strong romantic subplot, right? Yeah. Even though they may not be the main focus of the story. So how can we utilize like the agency? And you kind of touched upon it again, like I mentioned, in writing the romance plots or subplots.
Okay. Well, romance always comes down to chemistry. We have to feel that rightness of these two characters being together. I know as a romance reader and romance writer, you obviously have come across something where there's no chemistry. How do you feel when you read one of those kind of books?
I can't even finish because I get just so like, I'm just like where I just want them to make kissy faces at each other. And it's not like, I can't even feel like they're going to do anything. Like they're going to hang out together. They don't even seem like they'd be friends.
Yeah. And there was one major motion picture where the characters are forced to go on a road trip together and obviously fall in love. And you're given the female lead has a boyfriend in the beginning and he is awful. Awful, awful, awful. And so this guy's supposed to be nice by comparison, but he's still snarky and he's still broken. And I spent the entire film going, get out of the car, get out of the car, run away, go open a small business by yourself and be in a cozy mystery, because this is just not working. Because I could feel no rightness between the two, no chemistry whatsoever, right? Mm-hmm. And in order to get that, we have to feel that the characters aren't just stuck in proximity. Because a lot of times when you read work by beginning writers, they just think it's enough to put the two characters in physical space together. But I guarantee you, there are certain people that if you stuck them as the last two people on a deserted island, would still hate each other to the bitter end 50 years later. Because proximity does not give you everything you need to have romance. Mm-hmm. You've got to have empathy. And that's one of the things that leads to chemistry, is when we want to understand why these two want to be together. And if they don't care about each other, if they haven't found that empathy for each other on some real level for some real reason, then we're not going to feel it either. And a lot of times it's just, they don't talk. Mm-hmm. They're together. They kiss. They don't talk. It's like, okay, I don't understand why. And it's just the fact that you need to tell me why. I need to understand the character's motivations here. Mm-hmm. And empathy usually comes out of some kind of revelation. So you have a moment where these two characters, You've Got Mail. So you look at You've Got Mail and you look at those two characters at the beginning of the story. There's no reason why they would like each other. Mm-hmm. But you have this revelation that comes that they have been sharing emotions through these letters. And when they realize that this is a person who actually has more depth than they realized, all of a sudden there's this possibility of, can you change everything about your real life for this person, you know, inside? You have to have that way in, because if those two characters didn't have that connection and they were just, you know, the big bookstore and the little bookstore, and then somehow they met at a coffee shop and started talking, we wouldn't buy that, because there's no why. But when you get such a powerful why, that's why that movie is enduring. It's actually a remake of a film that was it based off of a book, or was it just, there was an older film? Because I know there's a black and white film called The Shop Around the Corner, because that plot was so powerful.
I think you're right. I think it's based on a previous film.
Yeah. And, you know, those plots are powerful because that kind of revelation, that kind of empathy, when those characters get that level of pity. And if you look at Plato and the whole thing with catharsis, as a reader, you have to have pity for the characters. So pity meaning an emotional end, right? Mm-hmm. Not that you are like, oh, poor baby, go away. But you have to have pity and fear to get catharsis. Mm-hmm. So pity, emotional empathy, fear that the character will not get what they want or that something bad will happen to them, allows us to have catharsis. And in a way, you have to have those characters having pity and fear for each other in order for that emotional catharsis in a romance to really work at the end. Because that's where we get inspired to have our own pity and fear, is from looking at what these characters are feeling. And so because of that fear for them to not get what they want or that something might happen, there's usually a desire to protect the other person. So that can work in so many different ways. You know, You've Got Mail, he suddenly wants to protect her from having her business fail. Mm-hmm. You have a whole subgenre of romance where the character is a bodyguard and there's, you know, physical danger to protect them from. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, you have empathy, revelation leading to pity and that need to protect. And then there has to be the agency, right? The viable mm-hmm. choices. And so there has to be a choice not to love, to love someone else, to remain alone, whatever it is, needs to be viably within the character's makeup. So the one that I come to for that is The Runaway Bride. Basically, that one is dissecting the whole tropes of romance. Mm-hmm. She has what seems like the picture perfect happy ending and she runs away from it, because psychological, we go back to that, what do they need from each other? She needs someone who can take the time to understand her. Mm-hmm. And none of these other people have taken the time. She's been able to hide who she is. And so, of course, it wasn't the right relationship, right? Mm-hmm. So she finally finds someone who takes the time, understands her for what she is, wants to know why she's been this way, and she still runs away. So her choice could be to keep running. She actually has to exercise agency to accept love when she finds it.
There's a great scene in that movie too, because it lives in my head rent-free all the time. So, but there's a great scene in that movie, because you mentioned agency, where Richard Gere's character, I think, I'm pretty sure it's him, who brings up to her, what are your favorite eggs? Because she constantly changes that one detail to match whoever she's marrying at that point or whoever she's with. And she doesn't really know, because she doesn't know, she really doesn't honestly know what she really likes. And so she takes the time. There's a whole scene where she takes like a quick, I think like 2 minute scene where she takes time to make eggs to figure out what she really likes.
Yeah. And to me, that's the most powerful scene in the entire film. Mm-hmm. I know you see really easy to get caught up in his speech at the end and his thing with the running shoes and everything. Yeah. But her turning point is when she figures out who she is and what she wants.
Exactly.
And then whenever she tells him that if they're going to ride off into the sunset, she wants her own horse. She has figured out who she is. Mm-hmm. And she has now got that psychological match with him. Whereas before he understands her, she needs to understand herself to be worthy of the love that he is offering. And in order to be an even match, because we always want romances to feel at the end that both characters are getting what they need. Because if it only feels like one character has gotten what they need out of the relationship, it feels very unsatisfying and might make you uncomfortable.
For me, at least, I know even if it's just one character driving the relationship, I want to see kind of a shared kind of that shared kind of agency between both, that they're both trying to make it work. Right.
Yeah.
So it makes like a really, really dynamic romance novel.
Yeah. And there has to be a barrier, right? Because if there's nothing standing in the way of their romance, they would instantly get together. There would be no real story. So you have to have them overcome something. And if only one of them overcomes something and the other one is just along for the ride, it doesn't feel like that other one is really invested in the relationship and is like, okay, yeah, I'll get together with you because why not?
Exactly. It's like, well, you're here.
Yeah.
But I love that you bring that up, because that's probably what the real romances that stick with me, where they find some kind of connection of some sort, like empathy you were kind of talking about, like that kind of connective tissue that really makes them say, oh, you might be my person, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, you can have something that starts out with the characters not understanding what the connection is. Mm-hmm. I definitely did that with the Chocoverse books, because when you go down to the psychological needs, each character is going to need something that's the best qualities of the other person that makes them a better fit than all of these other potential love interests she has floating around, right? And what she needs is his loyalty. But that's what she questions so much in the first book, because she doesn't understand what he's being loyal to or where it all comes from. Mm-hmm. But in the end, without him being loyal to her, once again, the ending could not have happened. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at the romance, Bo needs Brill's loyalty. He needs Bo's compassion, because he can't heal from everything that he's broken from without her compassion. And so those psychological needs drive the whole relationships between them. So then I've got this Bean to Bar book, and book two is about to come out, where I have a character who, I wanted the romance to be a little bit slower. I wanted more focus on the mystery. So she's a widow. Mm-hmm. And what she needs is someone with the patience to be there for her as a friend for a while she figures out how to process her grief and what she wants in the future. So she's got two love interests, and both of them are supplying that patience in very different ways. And then when you have a love triangle, there's obviously a choice between, I mean, it's agency in action. It's a choice between two possible futures. And so both of those characters, if you have an effective triangle, need to supply something different psychologically that the character needs. She obviously hasn't made up her mind yet, because I still have a couple of books left in the series planned. But yeah, she's got chemistry with both of them, because there is a rightness with either choice, which at this point I'm in the middle of drafting book three. It has her quite agonized because she doesn't feel like it's fair. And she's never been in this kind of situation. She hasn't made any promises to either one of them, but now she's just like, what do I do? And to me, that's a really good situation for a reader to feel that she could really belong with either one.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You talk about agency. You could go really mm-hmm. with either choice, since it does feel right. Like you said, and they kind of meet that psychological need, either one or the other, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So speaking of which, since we were talking about your Bean to Bar mystery series, you just had a recent release, now available, everybody. So can you give me, like, tell me a little bit about the series, maybe even about the new one, the new book.
Okay, so I have a character who was a physical therapist. She moved to Seattle with her husband. He was a marine engineer, and there was an accident. So he has passed away, and they had a dream when they first got together. They were going to have adventures. Mm-hmm. And then they took this chocolate making class. And this is actually a thing that people can do. And there are several shops in Seattle. There's one called Indie Chocolate that they do chocolate making classes. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit modeled on reality. So they took this class, and they decided that when he retired, they were going to open a bean to bar chocolate company, and they were going to travel the world, and it was going to be exciting and amazing. Well, he passes away, and in his memory, she decides to quit her job as a physical therapist, move home to Galveston, Texas, and open a bean to bar chocolate company. And so most of the agency in the first book comes from her deciding to live life for herself, rather than in memory of someone else, and to start making decisions that this company is hers because it's something she wants, not necessarily something that has been thrust upon her by obligation, because you can't hold on to obligation to a memory and still live your life. Mm-hmm. So that one was, grand openings can be murder. And, you know, she has the grand opening for her shop, and immediately one of her employees drops dead. She has to solve the murder. And this brings her into proximity to both of her love interests, one of whom is the one that got away. So she has been gone from Galveston for 15 years. He was her boyfriend in high school. They had a horrible misunderstanding and a horrible breakup. And so here he is 15 years later, and he's the cop taking lead on the case. So there's complication. And, you know, he's actually with someone else. So she's like, okay, well, that time has passed and life will be better. So then she also winds up with a second love interest, who is an ex-bodyguard who actually takes her seriously when she finds herself in danger after poking her nose in where it wasn't necessarily welcome to try and solve this murder. And so she winds up, as I said, mostly needing a friend. And she finds that in both of these relationships, from the new one and the past, while solving the murder, which is, of course, at the heart of everything. So the one that just came out, 70% Dark Intentions, you have a second murder that happens outside her shop to someone she does not know. And she gets drawn into solving it because one of her employees goes missing that same night. And several people have asked about the octopus on the cover. And that octopus is the employee that goes missing. His name is Mateo. Clive is Mateo's pet octopus. And she winds up going to his place to take care of Clive, which allows her to find out some things about Mateo and find some clues. So he actually does drive part of the plot. And he's rather amusing. He has a habit of eating anything he can get his hands on, including all of the expensive fish that Mateo had in the apartment. And Felicity feels a little bit bad about the fact that he's a Houdini, but she's doing her best. She has to get involved in this whole mystery. And she finds out more about both Logan and Arlo. And it seems like Arlo, who at this point still has somebody else in his life, is going to be really a good friend. And she's actually come to terms with the difference in the relationship now, and they're getting to know each other again. Mm-hmm. While at the same time, Logan becomes more of a active love interest.
Gotcha. Well, and I'm glad you brought up the octopus, because I was curious, because I was just like, it's it's a chocolate shop. I'm not sure where the octopus is coming into play, but so I'm glad you brought it up.
She has a pet rabbit. And so if you looked at the first one, he's the logo for all of her chocolate. And he's like the only thing that she really has from her life in Seattle. She's very protective of him and he's kind of protective of her. He actually plays into the plot in the first book.
Aw. I love how you always have like furry companions. Cute little furry companions.
I mean, come on now. In book three of the Chocoverse, I finally got the corgi on the cover.
I know. I was so happy because I was just like, I just want to see that cute little corgi.
Yeah.
So, and I have to ask because, you know, I know it's kind of a running theme. All your kind of works kind of have an element of chocolate. So why do you incorporate chocolate so often in your works?
So that actually started kind of accidentally. I had done with my husband, Jake, if you're watching any video, he has been walking back and forth while we've been chatting. He and I used to do things for the Fort Worth Herb Society. And we did some demos and a little book called You Can with Herbs. And the next year they were like, okay, we need you to do something even cooler than that. How are you going to top that? And so we brainstormed and we came up with there are herbs in my chocolate. So it was going to be all kinds of traditional recipes. At that time, it was just traditional stuff with chocolate and herbs. And so we did this demo with three different kinds of hot chocolate. So the French drinking chocolate, where they had the lavender and roses, that whole Aztec spice chili style chocolate. And we had done another one with thyme and orange, which was our tribute to the Terry's Orange. And we made a little recipe pamphlet. And about that same time, we got involved with DallasChocolate.org, which they do the chocolate festival every year, and had gotten to talk to one of the craft chocolate makers. So it was the guy from Amano Chocolate, excellent chocolate company, by the way. So we had chatted with him about some of the things that he was doing with craft chocolate and told him what we had done for the demos and all of that. And I was doing different lectures. So I was lecturing about gardening and garden railroading and crafting and all that kind of stuff. Victoriana Award for a year. I did a series of lectures for Royal Caribbean. So we went on a number of different cruises. And when I was talking to him about possibly doing a chocolate tasting, he was generous enough that he sent me some bars so that I could do the chocolate tasting aboard the ship. And it was a very interesting experience because we sailed out of Baltimore when I did that first chocolate demo. And the reaction was very split on people who were like, I have now found single origin dark chocolate. It has changed my life. Oh my goodness, this is wonderful. And people who were like, ew, this isn't chocolate. Because it single origin chocolate is kind of like wine. Everything has unique flavor notes. And we were talking about find the nuttiness, find the smokiness, all of that kind of stuff. And they were like, no, find me the milk chocolate.
Yeah.
And I had brought some, you know, commercial candies that were like my backup if I ran out of chocolate. And several people were like, can I just have those? And it was interesting to see what people really knew about chocolate. And then on that same cruise, we took a shore excursion and we were in the Dominican Republic in Samaná, and we got to see a cacao plantation in action. And one of the things that we found out is most of the time, whoever grows the cacao, they never actually get to eat the finished product because it's processed elsewhere. And, you know, like Mexican style chocolate or those tablets that come from certain places, that's the kind of chocolate that they were making on site. The guy actually had what amounted to a mortar and pestle that was about this big wide. And he had to use both hands to drive it. And he was making brown chocolate. And that's the kind of chocolate that they were eating. They would never have the finished bar that was made by somebody back in the States or in Europe or whatever. And all of that was rattling around in my head when NaNoWriMo showed up. And like I said, I made this 50,000 word. If you've ever seen a Tacoverse book, they're about 140,000 words a pop. So this 50,000 word basically novella that was just so much fun of all the things I had learned about chocolate. And then for some reason, that story just kind of stuck with me. And whenever I showed some of my different work to beta readers, that was the one they responded to. So I moved forward with it. And then while I was researching those books and promoting them, we got more involved with DallasChocolate.org. And I met all of these very interesting chocolate makers and realizes that basically nobody sets out to be a chocolate maker. Nobody decides I'm going to be Willy Wonka and actually does it when they grow up. A lot of times it's a second career or a passion that somebody took a class or they went to a lecture or something that just sparked an interest. And a lot of them used to be engineers or other professionals. So when we were in Mexico a couple of years ago in Monterey, we met a chocolate maker who he's from Monterey. He studied engineering in Japan. He worked for an engineering corporation until he decided to retire. Now his whole family is involved in his chocolate making operation. It's called Choco Solutions is part of the business and Menos de Cacao is the other part. And his son is involved, his daughter, and they teach chocolate makers from around the world at Origin. Because there, Monterey is a little bit north of where the cacao is grown. It's more in Chiapas. Mm-hmm. But he works with the university in that area to improve growing practices and all that kind of stuff. So there's so much to what is going on with craft chocolate. So you put that together with, you were probably at that WordFest where I did a demo in conjunction with Yelly from Yelly Belly Chocolates.
Yes.
And we were talking about how to do food in writing and mm-hmm. make people hungry and make them actually feel like they've eaten whatever it is you're talking about. And I just flippantly said, you know, there's a lot of chocolatiers because Yelly is a chocolatier, very different from a chocolate maker. So chocolatiers work with finished products in Cozy Mysteries. And there are some like almost mystical takes on making chocolate, but nobody is writing a honest to goodness, modern bean to bar craft chocolate maker, and somebody should. And so after that, I went home thinking about it and I'm like, well, somebody should. And I guess that somebody is me. And so I did. So I'm not saying that everything I write is going to have an element of chocolate. It's just all kind of tied together. And, you know, you want to kind of build a brand and, you know, build on what you've already researched and done. So it made sense.
Hey, and if you're going to do that, chocolate's a great thing to build it around. I mean, it is amazing.
It's like when hand selling the chocolate verse, I'm like, and then chocolate becomes Earth's only unique commodity and one of the most important things in the galaxy. And a lot of people go, isn't it already?
Fair point. Yeah. Now that we've kind of learned all about these books and the chocolate and everything, where can people find your books and how can they connect with you?
So anywhere online. So you can do the Amazon or Barnes and Noble thing. You can also request from your current indie bookstore if you want to support local. And then to find me online, I teach for UTA, so you can find a lineup of my upcoming classes on UTA's website under their continuing education enrichment section. I have a group that I lead called Saturday Night Write, and we meet once a month. We will be meeting third Saturday of every month online, at least through the end of the year. We'll rethink hybrid and figure out all of that as that time gets closer, but for my peace of mind, online through the end of the year, there's also a Facebook group that you can join for Saturday Night Write. My website is just www.amberroyer.com. There's lots of links. There's bonus recipes for the things. I have questions for book clubs, pretty much any information you want about what I've done. And I'm also very active on Instagram. I'm all over social media, but Instagram is my favorite, and that's where you're going to find all my coffee posts.
Thanks so much to Amber Royer for joining the podcast. Book recommendations for this episode is Amber Royer's Bean to Bar mystery series. Grand Openings Can Be Murder and 70% Dark Intentions. And if you'd like to stay up to date with what I'm working on, be sure to follow me at Romance the Story on Instagram and Twitter. As always, I hope you'll be healthy, stay safe, and take care of yourself. Bye!